Hello.
Stacy?
Hey, Ari. Hey. I apologize. I made the mistake of answering a call. It was an elderly woman who wanted to explain to me all the things that I needed to do to save democracy.
I feel like that's probably just like your day every day, though. People calling you about how to save democracy.
It is. And they have some very good ideas that if we lived in a free and fair society would work.
So I appreciate you taking the time. I know you're really busy. It's great to talk to you as always.
You as well. Thank you.
Those two voices, you know them. That's Mother Jones voting rights reporter Ari Berman and Stacey Abrams, the voting rights powerhouse who transformed the political landscape in Georgia and, as a result, the country. You're going to hear that conversation today because your voting rights are under attack once again. This is the Mother Jones Podcast. I'm Jamila King in Brooklyn. On today's show, some of the biggest possible changes to how you vote in this country are on the table right now. It's a reform package of epic proportions, but it's not clear if it'll pass because of how the Senate works. You might have thought that a bunch of this went away in 2020 after Donald Trump was ousted from office, but you're wrong. The war on voting has only increased. And remember when Georgia flipped blue? You're going to hear Stacey Abrams. That's right, the woman herself of the hour, talking about the new voting rights bill, voter suppression laws in Georgia, your rights under attack. We're getting into it with Stacey Abrams and Ari Berman. Stick around. Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones and our voting rights expert. He's been closely tracking everything going on. Ari, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jamila. Good to talk to you again. Thanks.
Ari, I'm seeing you everywhere, on TV, on Twitter. That usually means there's something bad happening for democracy. What's going on now?
Yeah, I thought I was going to get a break after the election, and somehow I'm busier now than I was before the election, which usually means something really bad is happening to democracy and voting rights. And indeed, that is the case. In the 2 months following the election, so in the first 2 months of this year, Republicans have introduced 253 bills to restrict voting rights in 43 states, which is a stunning number. We are seeing all across the country Trump's big lie that the election was stolen be weaponized by Republicans at the state level to push policies that would make it harder to vote in places like Georgia, Iowa, Florida, any state where they have power, the first thing they're doing, or among the first things they're doing, is trying to make it harder to vote, particularly for Democratic-leaning constituencies.
Let's start with H.R. 1, or what's been dubbed the For the People bill. Tell us, what's in that bill?
H.R. 1 is the most significant democracy reform bill since the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965.
Madam Speaker, I rise today in strong support of H.R. 1, the For the People Act of 2021.
It would make it easier for millions of people to vote in federal elections by adopting policies nationwide like automatic registration.
Reforms like absentee voting and early voting.
Election day registration.
Minimum standards for the number and location of ballot drop boxes.
2 weeks of early voting. Restoring voting rights to people with past felony convictions. Stopping discriminatory voter ID laws and voter purges.
Addresses challenges faced by Native American voters living on tribal lands.
Having independent redistricting commissions instead of extreme gerrymandering. Public financing of elections.
H.R. 1 begins to remove the advantages of dark money and secret donors.
This would make the political system a lot more fair, and it would open up voting access for millions of people because Congress has the power to set rules for federal elections, meaning that when you would go to vote for a member of Congress or you would vote in the presidential race, these pro-voter policies like automatic registration or 2 weeks of early voting or nonpartisan redistricting, these would be in place for federal elections in every single state. And that would go a long way towards stopping the kind of rampant voter suppression efforts that we're seeing introduced and passed by Republicans in state after state.
You recently wrote about how a case at the Supreme Court is challenging what's left of the Voting Rights Act, and that it could essentially neuter the law. What's that about?
So remember, in 2013, the Supreme Court gutted the heart of the Voting Rights Act and ruled that states with a long history of discrimination no longer have to approve their voting changes with the federal government. And that allowed states like Georgia and Texas to put in place new restrictions on voting. But it left in place another part of the Voting Rights Act that applies nationwide that can challenge measures that restrict voting access for people of color. And now Republicans are trying to kill that part of the Voting Rights Act. So they already gutted one part of the law. Now they're trying to kill another part of the law. What that would mean is that at a time when Republicans are passing all of these new voter suppression efforts that very likely violate the Voting Rights Act would be so weakened that it cannot protect minority voters from this new wave of voter suppression. So it's really kind of like a twofer what they're doing. They're passing all of these restrictions on voting, then they're trying to gut the landmark voting rights law that would stop these efforts from being essentially enacted into law.
So HR 1 wants to replace and update the Voting Rights Act, essentially. Where does it stand now?
So let me just break it down for you. There are two different bills. There's HR 1, the For the People Act, and then there's HR 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, to restore the Voting Rights Act. And HR 1 basically recommends that the Congress restore the Voting Rights Act, but that actually has to be done in a separate piece of legislation, which is called HR 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. And where they both stand now is the John Lewis Voting Rights Act has not been passed recently by either house. So that's going to take a little bit longer. But HR 1 has been passed by the House, and it now goes to the Senate, where it is not expected to get 60 votes. Therefore, it is going to have to either be able to overcome a Republican filibuster, or more likely, Democrats are going to have to get rid of the filibuster to pass HR 1 and other voting rights legislation.
How can Republicans block the legislation even if it's supported by the majority of Americans?
Well, that's why the filibuster is so evil, because 41 Republican senators representing just 21% of the country can block laws supported by a huge majority of Americans, including the For the People Act, which is supported by 68% of Americans. And I think Democrats have a huge choice here because the filibuster is a remnant of Jim Crow. It was used to block civil rights laws and voting rights laws for so long. And if Democrats don't get rid of the filibuster, they won't be able to block the next wave of Jim Crow 2.0 laws. I mean, I think that's really the stakes here. And this is probably the most consequential decision that Democrats have had to make as it pertains to American democracy in decades. They can keep the filibuster and basically get nothing done and allow Republicans to block bill after bill, or they can get rid of the filibuster in general or for specific bills that relate to voting rights, and they can really take decisive action to protect American democracy. But they can't do both. They're not going to be able to keep the filibuster and protect American democracy. It's one or the other at this point, and that's the choice that Senate Democrats face.
Ari, you talked to Stacey Abrams. We all know her as the formidable voting rights proponent who once ran for governor of Georgia in 2018. She's obviously in demand. Why did you want to talk to her right now?
I think Georgia is really ground zero for Republican efforts to make it harder to vote, but also just ground zero for this larger fight over political power in America. And Stacey is really at the center of these battles. And so I think she's a fascinating person to talk to anytime, as you know, Jamila, because you've talked to her a lot as well. But I think she's a particularly fascinating person to talk to at this moment in American history.
Here's Ari Berman in conversation with Stacey Abrams.
Does the attack on voting rights at the state level make the passage of H.R. 1, the For the People Act, and H.R. 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, more urgent?
Demography is creating an existential crisis. Well, Republicans unchecked are creating an existential crisis for democracy. We have to ensure that Republicans cannot deny eligible voters their ability to engage in democracy. They're doing so by rolling back the clock on voting rights. And the only way to head that off is to invoke the Elections Clause of the Constitution, which allows the Congress and the Congress alone to set the time, place, and manner of elections at a federal level. And H.R. 1 is the start. It's the reform we need that will provide protection provide a foundational level of access regardless of your geography. And we have to pass H.R. 4, the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which will be the protection that once we have the standard, we then have to have the oversight and protection to make certain we don't watch it be butchered or eviscerated as it has been in the last 20 years.
Should we abolish the filibuster to pass these bills?
I do not support the filibuster. I understand the institutionalists who are concerned about minority rule. I would argue, though, that what is being done to voting rights is the antithesis of an attempt to support minority rule. And Republicans should be able to have it both ways. They can't continue to attack Democrats for calling for the end of the filibuster by saying we're not respecting existing rules that are meant to empower the minority while they're still trying to snatch power away from elections officials and from voters in Georgia and Arizona and Michigan and Iowa. And so what I would say, though, is as someone who has been in one of these bodies, that we have to understand that, yes, it is a racist procedural rule that is grounded in this notion that the minority must be protected unless we disagree with what the minority needs out in within our nation. I believe that we need to offer a narrowly tailored version of a filibuster that is grounded in the constitutional principle that there are certain responsibilities that only Congress can meet. And I think that's the underpinning for existing exceptions. The judicial appointment exception, the cabinet appointment exception, the budget reconciliation exception are all grounded in this idea that these are constitutionally prescribed responsibilities that should not be thwarted by minority imposition. And we should add to it the right to protect democracy. It is a foundational principle in our country, and it is an explicit role and responsibility accorded only to Congress in the Elections Clause in the Constitution.
How did you feel when you woke up on January 6th after Democrats had won those two Senate elections? And when did your mood start to turn as you became aware of the insurrection at the Capitol? And what did it tell you about the country that these two things happened back to back? This incredible multiracial electorate followed by this insurrection led by white supremacists at the Capitol.
I woke up happy for my friends who had won their seats. I was excited for our country because I know what it means to have leadership that would push for COVID relief. I've got friends and family who are suffering and have been suffering, waiting for there to be true relief that addresses their challenges. Later that morning, I was actually talking to my friend, the new Congresswoman Nikema Williams. She was in DC, and I called to check in on her because they had been removed. You know, she was in that last group of people who were supposed to go in for the votes on approving the Electoral College decisions. Only she was cowering in her office. And I'm on the phone with her as she describes the terror and the fear and what she's hearing. I got off the phone with her because she needed to call her family again and remind them or update them on how she was doing. And the reality is I was as stunned as any American, but it was not surprise. It was the inevitable consequence of the kind of fear-mongering and hatred-filled invective that had come from the president, had been repeated so often on social media by those who supported it, but it also had its grounding in the veneration of traitors. When you saw those Confederate flags waving inside the U.S. Capitol, it reminded me of every day of my life growing up in Mississippi, where I could not see a state flag without being confronted with a Confederate battle emblem. It was a part of the state flag of Mississippi until this year. It was a part of the Georgia flag until a couple of decades ago, a symbol of the kind of nativism, nationalism, and white supremacy that says that the demographic changes happening in America aren't a natural consequence of who we began to be when we were colonies created for freedom and for opportunity, that instead they see it as a threat. And I am always disappointed in anyone who would say that our diversity is a threat as opposed to an extraordinary opportunity.
Thank you.
Don't go away. We're going to hear more from Ari Berman and Stacey Abrams after the break. Trump's big lie, what's happening in Georgia, why it matters. Stick around. Hey, if you want to support us at the Mother Jones Podcast, it's really easy. Just follow us on your favorite podcast platform. Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen to podcasts, just hit that follow button. It'll help us out a lot. Thanks. The Mother Jones stories you're hearing right now are brought to you by our listeners and loyal readers who fuel our work. Audience support makes up 2/3 of the Mother Jones budget and helps our team dig deep on stories that matter. Make a donation at motherjones.com/give to keep our nonprofit newsroom humming. Again, that's motherjones.com/give. Welcome back to the show. We're here with senior reporter Ari Berman talking about voting rights and minority rule. Ari, our listeners may remember Trump fighting with Georgia over the 2020 election. And back then, they were heroes defending democracy, voting rights champions even. Is that accurate?
Well, that's what's so interesting about the state of Georgia is that Republicans were the ones who stood up to Trump and said that the election was secure, it was fair, that Joe Biden won legitimately. And now it's those same Republicans who are turning around and saying people don't have confidence in the election, so we therefore need to make it harder to vote. And it's like, you guys stood up to the guy that was undermining confidence in the election. So why aren't you standing up now and saying to the people of Georgia, the election was secure, the voting system worked, we don't need to make it harder to vote. If anything, we need to further expand voting access to increase confidence in the election. So it's very ironic to me that you had all these Republicans defending the legitimacy of the election in November, but now they say the election is perceived as illegitimate, and therefore we need to put in place all of these new barriers to voting. I don't think they can really have it both ways. They can't say it was a fair election and therefore say we need to get rid of all the things that made it a fair election.
What's happening with voting rights in Georgia today?
What's happening in Georgia today is that the legislature has passed the biggest rollback of voting rights in the state since the Jim Crow era. They have passed bills to repeal no-excuse absentee voting, which 1.3 million people used in November, including 450,000 Republicans. They have passed bills to cut weekend voting when Black churches hold souls to the polls, get out the vote drives. They have severely limited mail ballot drop boxes. They are giving election officials less time to send out mail ballots. They're giving voters less time to return them. Perhaps the most ridiculous thing they've done is to say that you can't give food or water to people waiting in line to vote. So they cut early voting, which is going to lead to longer lines at the polls. And they're saying you can't give someone a bottle of water while they're waiting in an 11-hour line in the Georgia Sun to be able to vote. And this just seems cruel and also unnecessary because Georgia did 3 recounts in the state. They found no evidence of fraud. The Republican Secretary of State and others in Georgia have said that the system worked. The system was accurate and fair. And so the question that so many people are asking is, if the system worked so well, why are you changing so many significant parts of it?
What does Stacey Abrams have to say about what's happening in Georgia right now?
She's very, very concerned about what's happening in Georgia right now.
In the last 2 election cycles, 2019 and 2020, we saw a dramatic increase in the number of voters of color who voted by mail, the number of young people who used early voting, the number of African Americans who voted on Saturday and Sunday. We saw unprecedented levels of turnout across the board. And so every single metric of voter access that has been a good in Georgia is now under attack.
Remember, Stacey both fought voter suppression and was a victim of voter suppression in her 2018 governor's race when she ran against Brian Kemp, who was both the Secretary of State and the candidate for governor and seemed to use the state's voting laws as a weapon against her. But she's also spent the last 2 years since losing that governor's race trying to expand voting access in Georgia. And I think she believes that one of the reasons why Joe Biden carried the state and one of the reasons why Democrats elected two Democratic senators in the state is because they were able to expand voting access in Georgia. They were able to make the election rules more fair so that you could have this unprecedented turnout of young people and voters of color in Georgia.
We saw dramatic increases in the numbers of people of color who were using those perquisites. More Black voters turning out to use early voting. In 2018, it was the first year that Democrats, which are largely comprised of communities of color, was the first year that Democrats won vote by mail. 2021, the Senate runoff, was the first year that Democrats, again, people of color, won both early voting and mail-in voting. The only difference between this election cycle, the 2018 election cycle, and all the previous cycles where they were perfectly happy with and content with the system is that Black and brown voters are using those tools in ways that they had not seen before, and they have been successful in electing representation that reflects their values.
And that's the very thing that Republicans are trying to attack. And she knows, and she told me, there's no way they would have done this if Democrats didn't win the state in both November and January. So this is a direct response to not only Democrats winning Georgia, but the fact that the demographics of Georgia are changing, that it is becoming a younger and more diverse state. And that really threatens a Republican Party that right now is doubling down on white power all across the country.
This is entirely driven by the existential crisis of a Republican Party that has decided that rather than adapt to the changing needs of the populace, changing their policy thrust, not their ideology, but their policy thrust to meet the needs of the people, it is easier to stop the people from participating. And the only real difference between now and 2005, 2010, is the demography. We will be a majority minority state likely by the end of this decade.
So Ari, what does all this mean? Should we be hopeful about the future of voting rights in this country? And how do we stay vigilant?
Well, it's hard to feel hopeful about the future of voting rights in America when Republicans are pushing 253 bills in 43 states in 2 months to restrict voting rights, all predicated on a big lie that's been debunked over and over that the election was stolen in 2020 from Donald Trump. It's hard to feel hopeful when you look at everything that's going on in terms of making it harder to vote. The hopeful thing is that this is getting a lot more attention and that in Congress, Democrats are really making a big effort to try to protect voting rights through the For the People Act and through the John Lewis Voting Rights Act. If Democrats in Congress are able to pass the For the People Act, pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act to stop voter suppression, I will feel a lot better about the future. If Republicans are able to undermine access to the ballot all across the country and Democrats don't pass any legislation at the federal level in response to that, it's going to be hard to feel hopeful and it's going to feel like democracy is going to get a whole lot worse.
Ari, it's always so good and informative to have you on the show. Thanks for stopping by.
Jamila, always great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Stacey Abrams is the founder of Fair Fight Action, a voting rights organization based in Georgia. Ari Berman is a senior reporter at Mother Jones.
I'm Molly Schwartz, and I'm a fellow in the New York City office. Here are the credits for today's show. Theme music for the Mother Jones podcast is composed by Micah Barrick at Hear Film. Today's episode was reported by Ari Berman. It was produced by me, Molly Schwartz, the associate producer, and Sam Van Pikeren. Mixing and mastering was by James West, our executive producer, with additional production by Mark Kalinowski, our managing producer, and Jamila King. And this week, I want to give a very special shout out to Ari's bunny, Cookie.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
My bunny ate my ring light, so I had to get another one.
Are you serious?
I thought he was just like sitting in the corner like two nights ago, like just resting, and he was chewing up the ring light cord. Little freak. This is what he did to it. cookie.
One last thing before we go, there is still time to fill out our listener survey at motherjones.com/survey. Go check it out, motherjones.com/survey. That's it for this week's show. I'm your host, Jamila King. As always, if you want to support us here at the Mother Jones Podcast, it is very easy to do. Just go to wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us. I'll see you next week. This podcast is brought to you by Mother Jones listeners like you who donate to keep our newsroom buzzing. Help us stay on the beat. Go to motherjones.com/give.